So as we know, the Constitution remains committed to upholding rights to dignity and equality, and most notably in the press regarding race. The Human Rights Commission has upheld these rights in cases such as the likes of the deceased racist Penny Sparrow, Vicky Momberg, who served time, Angelo Agrizi and Andrew Katsavelos, both sentenced to pay hundreds of thousands of rand each for their abuse of the K expletive in their description of black people. Now, neither the Constitution nor the Human Rights Commission has ruled on what we are about to discuss in any way, nor has any active precedent been set. However, the CCMA has weighed in on the use of the word boer through Makhanya versus Saint-Gobain, a 2019 Labour case. The CCMA has held that the word boer in and of itself is derogatory and as derogatory as the K expletive at that, and dismissed an application for an unfair dismissal from an African employee's use of the word. Michael Yates is the Director of Employment Practice at Cliff Dekker Hofmeyr, and he joins me this morning to unpack this case and what it implies for how we engage with one another in the workplace. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning, Rufilwe. Thank you for having me.
Indeed. Thank you so much for taking the time. Won't you please help us understand, do you have any detail, more detail on the case, for example, any sense of the context in which the word boer was used?
So yes. Look, firstly, let me just quickly unpack that. It's not as simple as just to say that the word boer itself is derogative or anything of the sort in the workplace. It has to deal with the context in which the utterance is made, as well as the historical connotation that the word has within the context that it is made. Where certain words are overtly racist, certain terms could be neutral in the ordinary context, but when used within a particular context, it could attract a sort of racist connotation. Now, in this particular matter, it involved a dispute between parties in which the one individual said to another that you rule this place with an iron fist. You think it's the time when the Boers were ruling, and in the context that was held to be racist and had racist connotations because even the word Boer had an offensive undertone to it. So what is important is just for people to understand that it depends very much in which context a neutral word is used together with its historical significance in order to determine whether it could be considered racist or not.
I'm with you. And so this starts to point towards more of I've just lost the word that the Human Rights Commission sort of looks at, crimen injuria, I suppose.
Yes.
It points more toward that, doesn't it? In terms of it's the debasing or the indignity of treatment toward a person more so than the word, or is the word being added to the lexicon of crimen injuria precedent, I suppose?
Well, correct. I mean, people who publicly use derogatory words and other expressions of racism may face legal sanctions, you know, including private claims for defamation, as well as you put it, crimen injuria. It really comes down to whether you try to classify a person as an other,
yes,
something other than human, I suppose. You know, we have a history in this country in which the K word is probably the worst insult that could ever be visited upon an African person in South Africa, and more so particularly when that word is used by a white person. But you know, when we look at certain words which could be construed as completely neutral, we had a case in the Constitutional Court last year,
yeah,
in which the word swartman was used.
Yes.
And even though normally if it is used as a descriptor, it wouldn't have any racist connotations. But in the context in which that word was used, and the environment in which it was used, the Constitutional Court confirmed that the word did have the effect of putting a person in a other category, other than a human, so to speak. And it was found that the individual's dismissal was fair. But it would be unfair to say that the use of the word swartman or even the use of the word boer in an ordinary context would constitute racist and language and deserving of dismissal.
Okay. This is helpful as to some extent to me. I mean, I think the I would imagine that the sentence is it more than the word, only because I've been in contexts where a male science teacher, for example, of mine, who was quite sexist, when shouting at somebody who maybe dropped a test tube, would say, "Stop doing that, woman," you know, which is a form of sort of insulting, you know, a person who is a woman, because they, you know, the sense that they're less dumb and it's science and it's not really their field that they should be in. And I've observed him speaking to, you know, saying, "Oh, you'll land up just reading Fair Lady, woman," or whatever. Then the word woman has now been weaponized in the form of insult, as opposed to the word woman being needing to be absolutely excluded from the lexicon. Is it that kind of thing?
Absolutely. But you know, it goes a lot deeper, particularly when it comes to race issues in South Africa, because we had a case in our constitutional court also in 2018, which seems to have been quite a busy year for the constitutional court when dealing with race issues. But in that particular strike, 9 employees were charged and dismissed for singing a struggle song, which also contained, ironically, the word Boer. And the Constitutional Court looked at the arbitrator's reasoning and recognized the fact that the arbitrator took the history and the context of struggle songs into consideration in the context in which it was sung, and the fact that the arbitrator at the CCMA did find that it may have been racially offensive, it may not have been deserving of the ultimate sanction being dismissal in the workplace. Because the struggle song had a place in South African history, and the Constitutional Court found that the arbitrator's ruling in that respect wasn't necessarily unreasonable, and therefore dismissed the appeal from the employer. But the long and short of it is that you really have to delve into the history and the current context in which certain words are used, and I'll admit that it does put employees on certain uncertain or uneven grounds to know whether what you have said or not said would it constitute some form of racial slur. And fortunately, we received some guidance in our constitutional court as well on this, where in cases of indirect racism, what is expected of an employee is to perhaps just acknowledge that what they may have said, even though they didn't appreciate it at the time, may have constituted a racial connotation, to at least take ownership of it and to acknowledge that it was wrong and to show or demonstrate a willingness to alter your behavior.
And we don't have to go all the way.
Correct, yes. And that's the way that you really try to salvage the situation. But where you have a complete denial of wrongdoing, or at least a complete lack of appreciation that what you have said may have caused offense to somebody, and refuse to see the other side, the courts frown on that lack of appreciation, lack of wrongdoing, because how do you rehabilitate yourself? How do you rehabilitate a country where persons are unwilling to see or at least acknowledge that what they may have said could have caused offense to another?
You know, that's a whole other level of the discussion, which is a really important one. I'm chatting to Michael Yates, Director of Employment Practice at Cliffdekker Hofmeyr. If you have any of these experiences in the workplace, you know, he's giving us some really great insight here on how to approach something before it escalates all the way to the legal level. How have you tried to diffuse an uncomfortable or tense moment that has been steeped in racism, and has the receiving party been receptive to your intervention? Have you seen it happening to a colleague of yours and tried to help? Do call us on 021-446-0567, or if you have any questions for Michael, do stay tuned to Upfront. But we're talking to Michael Yates, who's the Director of Employment Practice at Cliffdekker Hofmeyr. I'm asking you if you would like to give us a call about whether or not you've been in a tense environment in the workplace, racial tension could have been diffused or has been diffused, or you intervened to diffuse it by having this intervention that Michael suggests of just pointing it out, highlighting that it's offensive, and maybe sort of letting heads cool. You guys never fail to disappoint. Excuse me. You never disappoint is what I mean. Sorry, Michael. Here's a WhatsApp from one of you saying, hi, Refilu, could I please have 1 kg of farmer's wors, a.k.a. boerewors? Ha, ha, ha. Yeah, well, this is the reason we're chatting to Michael, is that we don't have to go that far. The context really does matter. Michael, the next question I wanted to ask you is something that you kind of alludes to what you mentioned a little earlier. For me, one of the things of interest is that the K word, for example, that has come under scrutiny in these constitutional court cases that you mentioned, is a word that was imposed upon black people, and is a racial epithet in and of itself, right? Whereas boer is, on the other hand, is a self-defined and imposed word by the Afrikaner nation, to my knowledge, and a source of pride. I just want to understand a little bit better how we navigate, you know, many words can be weaponized. How do we navigate going forward in terms of the precedent that this sets?
Correct. Look, I mean, the K word is overtly racism. I mean, it's recognized, it's common knowledge, whereas the word boer could have double meanings, either in a neutral sense or in the offensive sense. Now focusing on the offensive connotation to it, there are a lot of white South Africans that do not agree and never agreed with what had happened in the past or reconciled themselves with what has become a collective term of the Boers. And some individuals may find it offensive to be connotized, if I could say it that way, with a grouping of people who oppressed another nation, and they find it abhorrent or at least distasteful to be classified as such. And really that's where the distinguishing feature comes in, whether the use of the word boer was intended to harm and this caused disharmony in the workplace. It is a tricky question because obviously there is I almost want to call it a sentiment towards the word in terms of struggle songs.
Yes,
our courts are prepared to give recognition to the fact that there is a lot of hurt in our country, and we shouldn't necessarily outlaw or completely discount the value that struggle songs have had in our history. But if it is used to diminish or to minimize somebody else's stature in society, that kind of behavior should be and must be rooted out in the workplace, at
sure.
least.
I mean, in the workplace, at least. It's difficult. Yeah, okay, no, actually, I take the point. Basil, one of our listeners, says, hi, Refilu, my son is at university where he is regularly called white boy by so-called woke fellow students. He feels unhappy and unable to respond to these comments without being called racist. I mean, to your point about being able to call out an offensive moment, I know this is not necessarily the workplace, but I think, you know, university kind of gets replicated in the workplace and these kinds of relationships. It's quite professional, but can be, you know, collegial. How does somebody, given the very, very true and thoughtful look that you're giving to our history, which makes it a bit unique in South Africa, how does a young white child navigate being called white boy like this without being sort of seen as, I guess, denialist,
yes.
you know, or if or as far as racist?
Yes, and look, unfortunately, these are the kind of dealings that we are grappling with, coming to terms with our history in South Africa. And many institutions, such as universities, would have policies that deal with racial tensions in the workplace, and without trying to get to grips with the factual details of this particular case, you know, parties can look towards the management of the institution to find out if there are workplace policies, university policies dealing with this kind of thing, and whether he's able to lodge a grievance or at least lodge a complaint with the university in relation to these things. But yes, it does. These are issues that are difficult to deal with, especially from an emotional point of view as well. but you have to face them head on.
Yeah. And then, of course, speaking of facing things head on, it's also important not to shut down conversation, right? So there's certain things that simply are factual about our history that can be discussed in the workplace. Or are we finding ourselves moving increasingly toward the American model, which is extremely litigious, where it actually ends up suffocating honest debate and discussion in certain professional settings like the workplace for fear of constitutional court rulings or CCMA rulings that may come out? Because, as you say, healing should be the outcome, and so honesty usually precedes that.
Look, I'm always of the view that the courts should be a measure of last resort.
Yes.
It's there where parties have reached an impasse and have been unable to resolve their disputes amicably between themselves. And, you know, the workplace and other institutions will have policies or procedures in place to try and facilitate conversation, to try and play a mediatory role, to try and come to some middle point or some form of resolution of the dispute without having the need to involve the courts. Of course, the court will have a place to play, a role to play in these kind of disputes. But, you know, we are a young democracy, and there's a lot of maturity that still needs to be developed.
Sure.
going forwards. But the parties should really try to sit and understand each other's point of view before resorting to litigation.
Because you can't litigate racism away at the end of the day.
No.
You probably create more hostility.
Correct. And you know, the Constitutional Court has actually recognized that fact, whereby it said, look, you can have this Rolls-Royce constitution, but the constitution and the rules won't necessarily change behavior. Unfortunately, that is a healing process that needs to take place going forward.
Sure.
And yes, the courts will have a heavy hand dealing with matters where a person is wrong. But yes, of course, there is some context to all of that needs to be taken into consideration.
Michael, just circling back on the legal front with respect to this ruling in the CCMA, what weight do CCMA, the commissioner's rulings, have in terms of the broader legal fraternity? Would there be any comment from the Constitutional Court? Does it set a precedent in any way of how we look at things?
Look, the CCMA, the arbitration awards in the CCMA are binding between the parties. It doesn't necessarily create a precedent for other CCMA arbitrators, but it does create a binding finding, and the parties don't have a right to appeal against the CCMA arbitration award. They can take it on review to the Labour Court. It's worthwhile looking at arbitration awards, because it gives you a sense or at least a dipstick approach in terms of what the current thinking is of CCMA arbitrators and what they would and would not consider to be fair and unfair. Ultimately, the CCMA is bound by orders of the Labour Court. The Labour Court's bound by orders of the Labour Appeal Court and so on and so forth.
Okay.
But yeah.
All right, that's very helpful. Thank you so much for the insight on both the law and the merits of the case in a broader sense. Michael Yates, Director of Employment Practice at Cliff Dekker Hofmeyr.